All right, good morning, everyone. It's good to see you all, and it's great to have such a prompt crowd this morning. It's wonderful to have you all here. We're going to be picking up again in Isaiah chapter 5. We don't have handouts this morning, and the reason for that is because we're still on the same handout that we were on last week and the week before that. So just hopefully you've got yours, and if not, there were some spares, and I couldn't find them this morning, so follow along as best you can. We're in Isaiah chapter 5 today. And I'm hoping we're gonna wrap it up and put a nice bow on it and get into chapter 6. But I actually don't mind, and my hope today is that we'll actually get into chapter 6 by the end of the lesson, but I don't actually mind sort of straddling the chapter division there. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is chapter divisions are artificial. They're not, they're a fairly late thing that was introduced a couple of 300 years ago or so, and they're not, I mean, they're often helpful. They're occasionally unhelpful because they make us be a little too segmented about the way that we divide up Scripture. So I don't actually mind bridging the chapter divide for that. Also, because chapter 6, as it turns out, it's really just a continuation of chapter 5. It's a really germane thing. The mood shifts. Something completely different happens, but it's placed the way it is in the text for a reason. And I hope you'll see that reason by the end of the day. So just a quick review of what we've looked at in chapter 5. We started out in chapter 5, obviously, 2 weeks ago with the parable of the vineyard. And then we got into this list of, there are really six specific woes, which are pronounced on six different groups of people. And those six groups of people more broadly divide into two larger groups. And the two larger groups were those who are dealing with what we have plastic-thick sins. So we came up with a little taxonomy for talking about these different kinds of sins. So we came up with sort of the thick sins and the clear sins. And the thick sins are these are the sins which are sins of the belly. They're sins of the flesh. The two examples which are given here are covetousness. So that's the first woe, was woe to a covetous people, verses 8 through 10. And the second was woe to a debauching people. So these are people who are just really, they're living for the party. They're surrounding themselves with noise. They're getting up early so they can start debauching sooner and not waste, time getting drunk for the day, things like that, which, again, it baffles me that this is a thing which people have done. And yet, historically, early morning drinking, that's one of the things that the ancient moralists, and we're talking all the way from Isaiah's time to 600-ish years later in Cicero's time, where you've got these moralists who are speaking against, getting up early and starting the morning off by drinking, which is something people did a lot in the ancient world. And I guess probably still do today. I don't do that, so I don't know about it, And so covetous people and debauching people, these are the thick sins. These are the people whose sins are driven by their belly. They're obsessed with gratifying themselves, with gratifying their flesh. And then there were what we talked about as the clear sins. These are the sins of the intellect, the sins of the spirit, the sins of the soul. And the first one was woe to an unbelieving people, people who don't believe that God is going to work. And so these are the people who, verses 18 and 19, who say, let him be quick, talking about God. Let him speed his work that we may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near and let it come that we may know it. These are the people who are really just sort of taunting God, if not in word, then at least in their attitude, in their spirits, in their hearts. They have this sort of taunting attitude that they want to, if God is real, why doesn't he just fill in the blank? And then, of course, there are a lot of people, a lot of atheists who will say this outright, but I think there are also a lot of people in our churches who have this attitude, maybe don't realize it, or maybe don't say it overtly, but maybe you feel like, you don't look to see God working. You don't look to see God working in other people's lives or in your life. And when God does work, maybe God works to chastise you, or God works to bless you in some way. You chalk it up to, oh, well, that's just a natural phenomena, as though God did not work through natural phenomena. So the unbelieving people, and then the next woe was woe to a truth-perverting people. These are people who call good evil and evil good, who call darkness light and light darkness, who call bitter things sweet and sweet things bitter. And the picture we get here is of somebody who's completely inverted, completely turned on its head, the natural moral order of things, which I think very elegantly describes the sort of situation that we find ourselves in today. We're getting to the point, I really firmly believe, in which words, you know, words and terms don't mean anything at all. And several years ago, there was this huge push to towards what's a good way to say this? We have this cultural preoccupation with identity, right? And the word for which I really hate, and which every time I hear somebody use it in a personal context, I just want to wring their neck. Is branding. And when somebody starts talking to me about their personal brand, I'm just like, you're not a real human being anymore. Please stop. Just please stop. There's another planet for you. This is not the one that. And this idea of branding, and branding started out as the image that your company projects, right? You know, it's like you know, if you're Starbucks, you have a certain brand that is around certain things. It's around overpriced, terrible coffee, and No judgment there. Some of you got Starbucks this morning, and that's why you are here safely. And so please, yeah. No, that's fine. I do see your, yeah.
It's Oak Cliff
Coffee. Uh-huh, yeah, okay.
And this keeps it warm for like 7 hours.
Yes.
I have to confess, I'm pretty sure our brand is.
Yeah, there you go. So Starbucks has a specific brand that's built around a specific kind of experience. And it's not just a good specific kind of experience, it's a specific kind of customer. Like, if you walk into Starbucks, there's a certain kind of customer that it's going to be predominantly the people in Starbucks, right? Like, it's going to be, like, predominantly one sort of person. And you might have a few outliers in there, but like, you know, if you just sort of think in your head, what is the typical Starbucks customer? Like, I think you can, like, we can all conjure up an image. And they would all be a little bit different, but if we compared notes, we'd say, no, those are all pretty similar, you know? It started out with like corporate branding, and then it became about personal branding. And the idea of personal branding is that, and this is one of those things that really came about in the age of social media. And I'm a writer, and I've published some things, and so I've had a lot of people, you know, one of the things you get if you go to a writer's conference, and writer's conferences are kind of a mixed bag. There are two kinds of people who like writing. There are people who like to write, and there are people who like to write about writing. And writers' conferences are mostly the people who like to write about writing. They don't actually do any writing, they just write about why they're not writing. And those people bug me. But if you go to a writers' conference, one of the things they'll talk to you about is your personal brand. And basically, what it is is saying you have to develop this thing called a platform. Nobody knows what a platform actually is, but it's something along the lines of when you present yourself online, like on social media, on the Book of Face and the Twitter and whatever else people are using today, when you present yourself online, you're not supposed to present anything which might dilute your message. And so if you're somebody who writes about dog training. It seems like a specific example, but I've met this person. And he was a very nice guy. Like dog training, that's sort of the least objectionable thing you can possibly, like, you know. But you know, you meet somebody who's into dog training, and it's like, okay, well, don't post about anything that's not really dog training. Like, don't put up your personal stuff, or like, you don't want to dilute your message. You want people to think of, oh, he's the dog training guy. Like, that's the person I need to think of. And it's like this idea of curating, that's another word that gets thrown around a lot, curating your personal appearance to the world so that they only think about you in a certain way. And this really bugs me. But we do this in a lot of other contexts that aren't necessarily corporate or aren't necessarily social media, right? Right? And one of the things that we have this cultural preoccupation with is identity or branding or whatever else you want to call it. And it's this idea that and I'm so off point. But it's this idea that, you know, you can't just be yourself. You have to control the image that you present to other people, right? And I think that's one of those, like, to a certain extent, yes, one of the reasons that we have society is so that we're not all terrible. Like, you know, the fact that I actually have to deal with other human beings on a regular basis, it keeps me from doing a lot of awful things. And that's a good thing, right? That's a good thing. But it's one of those things that, you know, an excess of the good is where you just sort of start trying to control the appearance you give so you can please a certain set of people or so you can be thought about in a certain way. And this is not new to social media. This has been around a really long time. But as part of this obsession with identity, right, we've got, you know, special interest groups which have developed. So you've got people who identify themselves more by the subgroup that they're in than just being an actual person. And so you say, oh, well, I'm an, and there are different ways of doing this. You can divide people up by either voting blocks. Well, these are the evangelicals, and these are the millennials, and these are the whatever, right? And now the way to do it is by, you know, by sexual preference or sexual orientation or whatever else you want to call it. And you can say, well, I was born a man, but I actually feel like I'm a woman. So whether or not biologically that's true, I have to, like, you have to treat me like I'm a woman because you have to respect my opinion. All right, that seems a little... I mean, that really seems to be stretching a point. But okay, let's say... Also, I really would like to identify as 5'2". You know? I'm not 5'2". Biologically, I'm not 5'2", but I would like to self-identify as 5'2". I'm actually a 5'2" woman. Well, all right, but I'm also Asian. I don't look Asian. Like, where does this stop? Right? Like, where does it stop? Where can you just, you know, it's... But the thing is, we're getting, and I use those examples because I watched, and maybe a few of you saw it as well, that somebody did a video of a college campus recently where they went and asked people, and people said, well, I guess I would want to know why you thought that, but I would respect that as your... No! There is no reason you have to respect stupid things. It's not a rule. Right? Now you can... Now, we always have to love people, right? And I honestly very firmly believe that somebody who is operating under this delusion is somebody who needs a lot of help, and they need a lot of love, and they're in a very lost place, they're in a very confused place, they're in a very self-hating, self-denying place, and they need help through that, right? But what we've been trying to go so far as a society to create a safe place for people who have this problem, that what we have done is we've taken meanings and taken words and said these things don't mean anything at all. And that gets to be a problem. And there's sort of a cognitive dissonance which the left has not really figured out yet. And that is, well, we really want to ensure that these certain minority groups get a certain amount of representation in the workforce and in the political scene and all this different stuff. But then what do you do with somebody who says, I'm part of a minority group when they're clearly not? Like, do we just lump them in? There was that lady who was, you know, was saying she was an African American and she was in charge of the NAACP's, not the, no, that's college sports. No, I did get it. I always get those two flipped. Okay. Part of it, like, she was the head of the Washington State in the NAACP, and she had fooled everyone into thinking she was African American, and it turned out she wasn't. And, you know, it's like, what do you, you know? A lot of people are like, okay, well, do we respect her? If somebody can just pick their own gender, just out of thin air, why can't they pick their own ethnicity? Why can't they just pick their height? Words break down. They stop meaning things, right? And this is what our society's done. It's a truth-perverting people. There's a level of sin which is about saying, I know the truth and I'm going to go against it anyway. But this is one step beyond that. This is saying, you know what? all these terms, all these words, all these roles, all these different things upon which society has been built for all of human history. Like, we are officially one up on the Greeks and the Romans. It's not to say that people didn't, you know, used to be called cross-dressing. It's not to say people didn't cross-dress in Greek and Roman times, but everybody knew it was cross-dressing, and they made fun of it. You know, it wasn't a socially acceptable thing. It's not to say there weren't homosexual relations in Greek and Roman times. There were, but the moralist of the day, you know, spoke out against those things. And it's, you know, there were not perfect societies by any stretch, but this is the first time, to my knowledge, in human history where we've said, no, we have to take this whole natural order, we have to invert it, and we have to make a safe place for these things. I don't know of any time that's ever been done before. To truth-perverting people. And then woe to a self-wise people. And this is where we sort of left off last week. Because to be perverted in the way that Isaiah has just described, the word of God has to have been abandoned as a source of wisdom. That's why in verse 24, it says that they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. So in exchange, the people of Judah have fallen into a way of thinking. And what's the new term that we came up with that last week? We didn't actually come up with it, but we're going to start using it instead of worldview. Does anybody remember what it was? Social imaginary, yes, yes, someone who's paying attention, that's wonderful. For those of you who are new to the class, I don't like the word worldview, there we go. Because it has an implication that you can just sort of step outside of yourself and step outside of all the different worldviews and just sort of pick the one that you think is right and that you can sort of objectively make that choice. I think a social imaginary is a better term because basically it acknowledges that we're human beings living in time, surrounded by other human beings. We're influenced by our society. We're influenced by our culture. And that all of that does is it gives us an imaginary. In other words, a way of thinking about things we cannot see. That's what your imagination is a way of thinking about things you cannot see. You can use it to think about things that don't exist in the primary world, but you also use it all the time to think about things that do exist in the primary world, like love and hope. Faith. These are things you can't experience with your senses, and that is why God has given you your imagination. Very much of the way that we relate to God, not all of the ways that we relate to God, but many of the ways that we relate to God are using our imagination. So we all have this social imaginary, which has been created by the things that we've surrounded ourselves with, and our contact with those who come before us through books and literature and things like that, through art. And all of that creates this sort of milieu, this social imaginary in which we engage with these ideas and these things. And the social imaginary of Isaiah's day, and I think of our day as well, is one in which people do what is right in their own eyes. It's not an imaginary in which people appeal to any kind of a higher standard. And of course, this is one of the major shifts in Western thinking that has taken place since the Enlightenment. And so people have progressed from the mere blindness of excess. Remember where we started. People are just covetous. They want to put house next to house and building next to building and field next to field. People are drunkards and they're surrounding themselves with noise and they're just, you know, blind excess. Blindness to the goodness of the giver because you've become so obsessed with the gift. But now we've progressed to something completely different, and that's a total inversion of the moral order. And so in order to support that, in order to say, you know what, bitter things really are sweet. Why? Because I say so. So there's a self-wise people. And then the final woe that we're going to look at this morning is woe to a justice-perverting people. This is verses 22 and 23. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine. Now, it sounds like we're back to the wine thing, but just hang in there. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who acquit the guilty for a bribe and deprive the innocent of his right. So what Isaiah is saying here is that the leaders of Judah are not heroes for justice. They're not paragons of righteousness. What are they heroes at? What's the thing that they're really good at? Debauchery, drinking wine. They're not valiant in defense of their country. They're valiant in strong drink. Now, under such circumstances, in a place where good is evil and evil is good, where the leaders are debauched and corrupt and really just looking to line their own pockets and fill their own bellies, we should not be surprised to find miscarriages of justice. The description here is of judges who set the guilty free for a bribe while depriving the innocent of their property. The way that most ancient legal systems used to work, and this is true for the Jewish legal system of Isaiah's day. It's also true later on when you get the, I feel like I'm talking about Rome a lot today, but it's also true later on when you get to Rome and societies like that, that the prosecutor, if you were one prosecuting another, after the successful prosecution of your case, you were then allowed to seize the property of the person who had been found guilty. So it wasn't like there was a state, you know, pool of money and it's what they paid the attorneys out of or anything like that. There's no DA. There's nothing like that. The way it works is, you know, you say, oh, you know what? So-and-so committed a crime. We should get somebody to do something about this. And that person's incentive, the prosecutor's incentive, is going to be, if you win, you get this guy's property. Well, under those circumstances, you can certainly imagine that a corrupt judge who was promised a share of the property, which is going to be confiscated, and this did happen, in order to ensure a favorable verdict for the prosecuting party, that judge is not going to care so much about justice. They're just going to be caring about lining their own pockets. This is the sort of bribe which is talked about in Scripture. It's talked about in the book of Proverbs and several other places. And obviously, in our day and age, there are other kinds of corruptions of justice, but this is the specific kind that Isaiah is talking about here. These are judges who say, you know what, I could make this case go more favorably against widow so-and-so who has no one to speak for her, and you can have her lands if, you know, you just remember me when, you know, when that happens, when the money comes around. So it's this total inversion of the moral order has led to rampant injustice. Like, if people can just say, why, because I say so, then they can say so as often as they want to. And so we get to, what is the judgment going to be against this kind of people? So remember, the judgment for those who are consumed with their belly, consumed with the thick sins, was going to be that they were going to be swallowed up by hell, whose appetite is even more ravenous and even harder to satiate than theirs is. So what's the specific judgment which is coming for these clear sins? It says, therefore, verse 24, as the tongue of fire devours the stubble, and as dry grass sinks down into the flame, so their root will be as rottenness, and their blossom go up like dust. What's the metaphor that he's using here? What's the mental image? Somebody describe it for me.
The law just burn or rot away quickly.
It's gonna be consumed to ashes. It's all gonna burn and rot away quickly. Why? What's the implication of that? What's that? Well, that is why it's happening. But what's the implication of the mental image of something which is just burned up quickly?
It's weak and not long lasting.
Right. That's what I'm going for. I think that's what Isaiah is going for. Weak, it's not long lasting. It's not substantive. All right. If you've got a pile of dried out grass clippings, okay, or dryer lint, which is, I think, the most flammable thing on God's earth, is dryer lint. I've started a lot of good fires with dryer lint. Kids, take note. No, just kidding. Yes. Thank you for bringing your children.
Keep your dryers clean.
What's that?
Keep your dryers clean.
I don't want your house to burn down. Yeah, that's where, obviously, that is where I was going with that. Also, if you fill a tennis ball with match heads and then throw it against, no, don't do that. Don't do that. It explodes.
Done.
That's right.
So when it explodes, everybody will say, well, they were full of their clear sins.
That's, yes, full of their clear sins. That's right. when you have something like light and puffy like that, like it just burns up. Like there's no substance to it. If you have a really good log, you know, on your fire for your fireplace, like that log will burn for 3 or 4 hours, right? That's the whole point. Like you don't warm your house with dryer lint. Unless your house is burning down, in which case it is inherently warm, but it's a little too warm. I feel like I have lost control of the lesson here. But my point is, it's like stubble. Stubble is what? It's straw. It's dry grass and leaves. It, like dry grass, is going to sink down into flame. The root is going to be as rottenness. If you've ever dealt with a tree of or a plant of any kind that's dealing with rot, I think I've told you guys about the pear tree I had to cut up a couple of years ago that was dealing with dry rot. Like there's nothing to it. Like it just comes apart in your hands. It just crumbles in your hands. That is what Isaiah is saying, is that all of these things which you have been building for yourself, the iniquity you've been pulling behind yourself, all of your unbelief, and all of this elaborate structure, this elaborate social imaginary which you have had to build around yourself to justify your lifestyle, all of these things, when the rubber meets the road, are going to burn up in an instant. They're going to be gone, and you're going to be standing there before the judgment of God with nothing to protect you. For they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts. They have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against his people, and he stretched out his hand against them and struck them, and the mountains quaked, and their corpses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. That's a really graphic image, you guys. Like, refuse is what? It's garbage. It's trash. We've all, I'm sure, been to parts of town or anywhere in Michigan or, you know, where there was... I've been to Michigan a couple of times. Flint, actually, which is not a great example of really anything. But we've all been to places where there was just, like, litter. Just, like, trash in the streets. Like, you know, like, for that matter, certain yards in, like, East Texas, you know, you've got, like, the cars up on blocks and the washer and the dryer, which are still functional. They're just in the yard. I've literally seen a hose running up to a washing machine that was sitting in the yard. There was like an extension cord and a hose, and I was like, really? It's the idea of there's just garbage everywhere. Like it's garbage. It's like nobody cares about it. Why is there garbage on the side of the road? Because it's not $100 bills. Like if it was something people cared about, they would have picked it up. The amount of like ubiquity and devaluation and worthlessness that is normally given to garbage. Isaiah is saying the judgment that is coming is going to be so bad that bodies are going to be lying in the streets like garbage. And people are going to become so desensitized to it that they're not going to do anything about it. That's the mental image. Like you can think, you know, if I'm sure we've all got some images somewhere of like the Black Death or something. And like there's just like bodies everywhere and people are going through the streets and piling them up on the carts to take them away to be burned. And those are not pleasant images, but that's what Isaiah is trying to conjure up for us here. The idea that the social order which you have inverted cannot stand on its own. It is not substantive. It is dry grass that will burn up. It is rot that will collapse. And when it does, everything's going to come crumbling. For all his anger has not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. So verses 24 and 25 here give us the final therefore statement in this chapter. Remember that the first one dealt with sins that were due to excessive appetite. This second one deals with sins which run much deeper than a mere perversion of pleasure. It's not just about perverting a good pleasure anymore. That's how probably most of these sins started, but now they've progressed beyond that. It's almost a meta sin. It's a sin about sin. It's I want to keep sinning, and the only way I can keep sinning is if I make sin not sin anymore. And so you convince yourself, and you twist scripture, or you deny scripture altogether, and you twist the natural moral order, the natural law of the conscience, until you don't feel bad about what you're doing anymore. In fact, when you get to that point, it's really easy to pray it. Praise it. It's really easy to put it on TV or have a parade about it or go to church and wear it like a badge of honor. This is unbelief. This self-wisdom is vanity. It is all rottenness. It is all emptiness. There is nothing of substance, nothing to stand on when the fire of judgment burns it away. Why? Because they've rejected, and because we've rejected, the only thing which is substantive, the only thing which we can really found ourselves, ground ourselves in, and that is the word of God, the law of the Lord. And I want to say, these sins of unbelief, and I'm not just talking now about, you know, some of the big cultural ones that we've talked about, like people being confused about the way that God made them and things like that. I'm not just talking about that stuff now, because these sins of unbelief, intellectual or practical, the self-deceit, the self-wisdom, these are all things that Christians can do pretty effectively. And I think in many ways they are more dangerous than the sins of the appetite. Now, I'm not giving anybody, and those of you who know some of my personal history know that I'm definitely not giving anyone a pass on sins of the appetite. But the appetite, when it is given to God, when it is redeemed, it may be as powerful a force in leading a man or a woman towards God as it was driving him away from him. Because the appetite is a good thing. Of itself, without perversion, without sin, the appetite is a good thing. But unbelief, let me take a step back from that. Of itself, appetite is a thing. Right? It's a real thing. Unbelief is nothing. The road of unbelief is a road to nothingness. It is a road of toil in which we pull our sins after us, as Isaiah describes it here. It continually redefines and inverts our sense of right and wrong, of bitter and sweet, of fair and ugly, until there is no meaning left in the world. It is the path of delusion and illusion. It's the road that says there is no sun, there is no sky, that the sun and the sky are only pretty stories told by children or metaphors used by wise men to speak of things that we can really see, the roof and the lamp. It's to say that you know, God doesn't really exist. That's just a social construct. Well, at that point, you don't have something. Like, you don't have a thing. There's nothing about that idea, that way of thinking, that can be redeemed. The only way to deal with it is to burn it up and to build again. Because the sun and the sky are real. God is real. And these things are more real, and they're much bigger than any of our self-delusion can imagine. Because remember, again, when your imagination becomes perverted, you lose that. And that is what the word reason used to mean. Now when we say reason, we just mean like pure, like logic, like, you know, deductive reasoning or something like that. But the word reason used to mean man's higher faculty, which he uses to interact with the spiritual world and to interact with God. That's what reason used to mean. And when we do all of this, when we turn things on their head, we reject our reason. And when we do, the construct that we build in its place is just flimsy. It's made out of toothpicks. It's going to fall down at the first opportunity. It's going to fail us. And it is constantly failing us. And in the people in the world around you, you can see it failing them. And they're constantly having to build it up again and redefine something new. And that's why it seems like that the social boundaries just keep getting pushed and pushed and pushed again. It's not even so much that they're just getting pushed and pushed again. It's that the last terrible construction that somebody made fell down, and now they have to build a new one up, and it's even worse. But I don't want us to just look at the sins of the society in this passage. I want us to look at ours. Look for yourself. Because many people who do not struggle with sins of the flesh, sins of the appetite, do struggle with pride, which is a straw house. They do struggle with self-conceit and self-righteousness and all these other things, which are going to blow down when the wind comes along. So Isaiah finishes denouncing Judah's many sins, and now he resumes his poetic voice. And what he's going to do for us is he's going to paint a poetic image of the judgment, a foretaste of the judgment, which is to come. Now, you remember all the way back at the beginning of this chapter, in the parable of the vineyard, Isaiah say that, or what does God say that he's going to do as the husbandman of the vineyard, right? He's going to break down the hedge. Basically let the wild animals to come in and graze. Now we're going to find out who those wild animals are, what's going to be happening. It says, he will raise a signal. This is verse 26. He will raise a signal for nations far away and whistle for them from the ends of the earth, and behold, quickly, speedily, they come. I don't know why we keep talking about beekeeping so much in this class, but this whistle for them and they will come, this is a beekeeping metaphor. Apparently, beekeepers in the ancient world, I don't know if this really works. I can only give this to you on authority of people who wrote about beekeeping, which it seems like in the ancient world, they wrote about three things. They wrote about wars, beekeeping, and wine. And so those are three fairly well-documented subjects from the time of the Bible. And apparently beekeepers, the way that they would sort of call their bees in was by whistling. I don't know if this works. I have no idea if this works. I really want to know if this works.
Have you found it in the writings about whistling?
Yes! Yes! It's got to work. Like several different writers on pretty good authority say... it's in Virgil's Georgics, it's in some of the other ancient writers as well, like, apparently, they would whistle for their bees. I've never heard of anyone doing this until I read about it, but, I mean, it's gotta, like, apparently, a lot of people thought it was a thing. But that's what this is a beekeeping metaphor, it's whistling for them from the ends of the earth. Now, you remember, we did one other bee metaphor, right, way back, beginning of chapter 2. When we had all the nations of the world flowing towards Jerusalem, this is in the promised time to come, the promised termination, the completion of God's redemptive work for Judah and Israel, that all of the nations of the world were going to flow towards Jerusalem like bees returning home to a hive, right? Well, here's another mental image. And the mental image is the bees are coming, but maybe not in a super nice way. Don't know if you've ever been stung by a bee. I've been stung by many bees, and it was never a big deal. Wasps, on the other hand, forget that. Wasps will mess you up. Stay away from wasps. Now, bees, I actually used to... terrible things Richard did in his childhood, episode 347. There was a beehive next door, like, not on purpose. There was just a beehive, like in a tree. So I would get a Ziploc bag, and I would run over to the beehive, and I would clamp the Ziploc bag over the beehive, shake it up until the bees got really mad and filled the Ziploc bag, and then I would very quickly retract it and zip the Ziploc bag shut. What this leaves you with is a bag full of angry bees, who for about the next 3 hours, you have the equivalent in backyard neighborhood children wars of a nuclear bomb. Nobody messes with a guy with a bag of angry bees. If you have a bag of angry bees, what are you going to do? I wouldn't mess with a guy with a bag of angry bees because he's clearly crazier than I am. What might he do with those? But bees, flowing, speeding, behold, quickly, speedily they come. None is weary, none stumbles, none slumbers or sleeps. Not a waistband is loose, not a sandal strap is broken, their arrows are sharp, all their bows are bent, their horses' hooves seem like flint, and their wheels are like the whirlwind. The roaring is is like a lion, like young lions they roar, they growl and seize their prey, they carry it off, and none can rescue. I mean, it's a pretty, pretty striking mental image. If you imagine... you know, all the nations of the world coming in to do the judgment of God, coming like bees, coming like predatory animals, coming like bulls, coming like lions. Not a waistband is loose, not a sandal strap is broken. In other words, they are ready and they are well equipped, and they are not to be trifled. None is weary, none stumbles, none none slumbers or sleeps. They will growl over it in that day, like the growling of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold, darkness and distress, and the light is darkened by its clouds. So, the nations of the world are like, let's pick through the passage that we just read. Let's look for the metaphors. All right? I gave you the bees, one for free. What else are they like? Sorry? Roaring lions. Roaring lions, and says they will growl over it in that day. Have you ever seen a dog with, like, food or a bone, between his paws, and another dog walks up to it? I saw this morning. Another dog walks up to it, and the dog will just start very low, just start that slow, low growling that says, this is my food. And if you come near my food, you are also food. Okay. What are the other metaphors? An army. Yeah, I mean, and I think that's probably the most literal one of them. Okay, but pay attention to the language that's used about the army. We know it's going to be an army, but what specifically does it say about the army? They're very prepared. They are ready for this. They are, and you can sort of contrast that, I think, against the general drunkenness and the lack of preparation which the people of Judah have made. Like the leaders of Judah, I mean, they're getting up early to drink. They're heroes at drinking wine. And some really serious armies are about to show up. The eventually it's going to be the Assyrians and then the Babylonians are going to show up. I mean, the Assyrians invent siege warfare. Like, the Assyrians invent the scorched earth method of redistributing populations so that they amalgamate into the Assyrian Empire. Like, they're very strategic about this. They're very careful about this and methodical about this and well-planned. Like, these are not, they're not, yes. This is before the Romans did this. Yes, they did it less effectively at first. The way that the Roman Empire originally expanded is that they would conquer a province and then say, "Hey, we've liberated you. We're going to put up your own king, and he's going to rule." And they would put up like a puppet dictator. And then when that dictator died, usually Roman rule was good enough that everybody would sort of vote and say, you know what, instead of having another ridiculous dynastic king, Roman rule has been pretty good. We would just like to become a province of the Roman Empire. They actually conquered almost all of Asia Minor that way, with the various different provinces. Rome is also, it's going to be next week. When we start Isaiah chapter 6, it starts out with the words, "In the year that King Uzziah died." In the year that King Uzziah dies, depending on when that year is, there's about a 20-year period where we can say it's actually a 16-year period where we can say with very good authority, it happened somewhere in here, right? There's also it's actually about a 20-year period where we can say with a fair amount of certainty that a small little city on the Tiber was being founded, which would eventually sort of become a thing. As Judah is on the decline, that is when Rome is being founded. So they haven't come and done this yet. I was looking at the date for last night. I was sitting across from Sophie, and I was looking at the date, like dates for King Uzziah's death. I was like, "Why 739? Why does that seem so familiar?" So what else happened in 739? I couldn't remember what it was, and so I went and looked it up, and was like, "Oh, Rome was founded. That's what happened." Yeah, that seems like that'll be a thing at some point. It's really fun to actually fit the Bible into the rest of history and like get a point for where it goes. So. Judah is going this way, Rome is going this way. Okay. What's that? Oh, you're fine. It's a good question. So what are some of the other metaphors for animals here for the enemy?
The whirlwind with the wheels on the chariots.
Yeah, their wheels are like the whirlwind. Good one. I had missed that. Yeah. The wheels of their chariots are coming like the whirlwind. That's a really vivid mental image. I also like their hooves seem like flint. All right, what does flint do? Well, it's very hard, but it makes sparks. Yes. So here's this mental image of these chariots that are coming, and there's darkness and a storm all around, and that's the way this passage ends. So you've got like darkness and a storm all around, and here come the chariots of the enemy, and their wheels are spinning like a tornado, and the hooves of the horses are throwing up sparks as they ride. This is a really, like, this is really good stuff. This is a really vivid image. Like, you got to read this stuff carefully and like engage your imagination and think about it, because this is actually really cool. I mean, it's not so cool if you're Judah.
And you're like, hey, so you're just one spark
in your gun. So, no, that's really, yes, they're like straw, they're like chaff, they're like rubble. Like, one spark is all you need to send it up. No, that's really good. You guys are doing great today. This is wonderful. So Israel has abandoned the Lord, and so she herself will be abandoned to the most severe judgments. Now that the Mosaic covenant, which is what Judah is under, is a conditional covenant. If God says, Judah, if you abandon me, this is way back in Deuteronomy, if you abandon me, I'm going to abandon you to your enemies for judgment. It's not like the New Testament covenant in that regard. And so these things are going to culminate in the coming of an enemy from afar. And this is the conclusion and also the announcement of the punishment to be meted out for the sins mentioned. These sins, we are told, are an equivalent, they're a rejection of God. They're a rejection of Yahweh. And Yahweh, in return, is rejecting Israel. So God summons the nations of the world, whistling for them. Like the ancient writer said that beekeepers whistled to call their bees. And Isaiah finishes by describing our enemy in really vivid poetic language. The enemy is swift. They are unwearied. They have sharp arrows and a bent bow ready to shoot. They come roaring like young lions eager to seize their prey. They are coming like a storm. Night has fallen. Everything around is just heavy, unrelenting gloom. Because against Judah, Assyria is going to roar like the roaring of the sea. But I think also the unrelieved darkness here indicates a heavier judgment which is to come. Namely, that there's going to be no one to truly deliver, that Judah's going to go away into exile, and the wicked are going to go away eternally to outer darkness. So the sweep of sins which Isaiah condemns in Judah is so wide and it cuts so deep that it is impossible, I think, if we're really honest, to not find ourselves here. And I want to make sure this morning, as much as we've used examples from popular culture, that we're not just looking for other people's sins, but that we're looking for ourselves in these passages, which is what Isaiah is going to do in chapter 6. I think we'll talk about this next week. Personally, I believe that chronologically, Isaiah chapter 6 happens before chapter 1. Isaiah chapter 6 is the calling at the beginning of Isaiah's ministry, but he doesn't put it at the beginning of the book, he puts it after chapter 5. I think there's a really good reason for that. But we would do well to ask ourselves, which one of these things describes us? Are we living overmastered by appetites or our hobbies? Have we placed so much delight in our pleasures that we're no longer able to see in them the work of God? Have we even seriously tried to see the work of God in our daily treasures? We asked this question last week. Like, have we seriously tried to see the work of God in food, in music, in sex? Like to really enjoy that God is giving me good food. God is giving me good music. Why? Because he loves me, because he's a loving God. And this was made for my delight and for my enjoyment. Paul says all things in their proper way and in their proper place, but all things are yours through Christ. Are we living lives of practical unbelief? Do we not really expect to see God working? More importantly, do we not really expect to see God judging in the lives of Christians? Do we really earnestly seek to discern God's hand in judgment or in trial and know the difference? Or do we just tell ourselves whatever is most convenient to believe? That is, oh, this bad thing is happening to me. It's not because God is judging me. God couldn't possibly be wanting to get my attention for, and there's an opposite error which says every time something bad happens, that's God's judgment. But that's not what I'm talking about right now. If, do we tell ourselves whatever we feel is most convenient to feel good about ourselves instead of paying attention to how God is trying to work with us? Are there maybe some areas in our lives where we, and maybe it started out by reacting to somebody else's license or somebody else's legalism, have taken something which is evil and proud and selfish and self-serving and convinced ourselves or tried to convince others that it is a good. Are our spirits and senses really trained to discern what is good and beautiful from what is false and vain and ugly? Or are we just being carried along by the culture? And just as a reminder, just because you do not suffer from one of the sins that I've mentioned doesn't mean you're immune from the others. Just because you struggle with one of these doesn't mean that you don't struggle with all of them. There have been a lot of people who have moved from a sin of habitual appetite to living a life of practical unbelief. They've moved from, I have this pornography addiction, I have this overeating thing. And so rather than deal with it, rather than repent, rather than get accountability, rather than you know, really wrestle with it and acknowledge my own sinfulness and come clean about it, I'm going to go on in a life of practical unbelief that says God isn't really going to judge. It's not really going to catch up with me. I can get away with this. There have been a lot of people who have moved from a thick sin to a clear sin. But everything that is practiced in secret, every single thing, Jesus says, there's practice in secret, will be brought to light. Paul tells Timothy, there are some men's sins who are very apparent here and now, and there are some whose sins will follow them to the day of judgment. So clouds overshadow the land, and in these clouds is a heavy, brooding, breathable darkness. The land of Judah is covered, the light is gone, darkness reigns, and everything is black and still and heavy. And then, in chapter 6, next week, Isaiah will see the Lord.